Chapter 8. Siskern's sharp inhale told me all I needed to know. The Raptor man had pretty much overheard me telling Captain Tharfin basically everything he asked me not to, but I honestly couldn't see any way around it. Which sounded like a way lamer excuse than it actually was, and it made me seem like someone who didn't understand the concept of withholding information. But the simple fact was, all three of these peoples, the snooty uppish, the hard-working villagers of Snake Tree, and the soul-weary mindfolk had loads to benefit from if they would just come together already. And the only way I figured would work was if people of influence like Zaire and Tharfin made the steps. All I could supply was the facts as I knew them, so an informed decision could be met all around. That was my hope, anyway. But after I said what I did to the captain, I apparently stunned the man back into his usual stony silence. I wasn't sure if this was a good thing or not, but I was loath to break the peace, especially when Tharfin seemed to have lapsed into a contemplative headspace. I made sure not to disturb him the rest of the way, and even when we reached the bottom of the open pit to start setting up camp, I kept my distance and jumped in whenever I could help. This also had the added benefit of allowing me to avoid Siskern as much as I wanted to, which was a plus because part of me now felt a bit like I'd betrayed the regent by going against what he'd requested of me. But I'd only followed my intuition on the matter, and a much bigger part of me couldn't shake the feeling that I'd acted correctly regardless of Siskern's feelings. It was still a shitty place to be stuck between, though. Finally, camp was all set up, and I knew my avoiding the matter was about to come to a close. Surprisingly, however, it was Captain Tharfin who broke the silence when we were all around the fire a little later, and this time it wasn't me he was addressing.
"Regent Siskern,"
the captain started, as he scrutinized the Raptor man across from the fire.
"The ambassador here has been telling me all sorts of fascinating things."
Oh boy, here we go.
"He has he?"
Siskern commented as he shot me a brief glare, but I simply shrugged at him and tore off a chunk of dried jerky I'd brought as provisions.
"What has he told you?"
"It sounds as if the upper echelon is in just as bad of a shape as we lowish are," he said,
and as much as it put me on the spot, I appreciated the man's way of not mincing his words.
"If this is true, what are your plans in order to save your people?"
Siskern spluttered as if he couldn't quite comprehend what he was hearing, and after a good moment where he did a confused codfish impression, he cleared his throat.
"It is as you say, Captain,"
Siskern said, after I nodded to him in encouragement.
"The truth is, the Uppish have been flailing for quite some time, and are not in the position to oppress anyone. The Red Sky events have taken their toll on the Uppish militant forces, which are dwindling severely."
"Why don't your people fight?"
Tharfin questioned bluntly.
"After all, aren't they blessed by the goddess's ashes?"
"They have forgotten how," the regent said with a sad shrug. "Whatever Alex told you is the truth. The upper echelon is dying, but the nobles are too stubborn to realize. That is why I have been striving for a united tear."
"And how do you propose that's even possible?"
the captain challenged.
"You just said your lot are too stubborn to budge."
"Eventually they will need to face the truth," Siskern said. "Each red sky brings the upper echelon that much closer to extinction. When the time comes where true change is imminent, they will have no choice but to move aside."
"So, we show up on the palace steps and demand the lowers live alongside the uppers, and your plan is to hope they let us,"
Tharfin sneered. "It's not hope," I chimed in. "It's a fact."
"Explain,"
he said, as he pinned me with his orange eyes. "What Tear really needs is to form stronger bonds with allies outside of her walls," I began, and was ready for the scowl this would inspire. "Hear me out. I know Terrans hate outsiders, but have you ever wondered why? Where did the notion that outsiders were bad even come from? Is it based in fact, or was it a way of thinking passed down through the generations?
But the traveler I told you about, the captain said.
Yeah, he was shit, I conceded. But I'm an outsider too, and haven't I proved I'm nothing like that guy?
You have,
he nodded his smooth head. So the logic, all outsiders are bad, is flawed, I posited. Which means, if an outsider like me can be decent and fair, it stands to reason others like me will do the same. Actually, I have it on good authority the man you ran across was actually the exception to this, instead of the standard.
Your reasoning does make sense, he allowed. But what would uniting with outsiders even entail?
For one, it would be about boosting trade, I added.
Oof. More steel.
He gritted his teeth. Not necessarily, I tried to assuage him. The regent and I have been working on possible commodities that could replace the need for your people to have to harvest the sickening material.
We wouldn't have to mine for the ore.
Tharfin's eyes went just a fraction wider, but other than that, there was no indication he was intrigued. This made me think he was trying to be so stoic in order to smother his interest, and I set myself up for mentally reeling him in. If I wanted to persuade him, I needed to tread lightly and keep in mind that the captain suffered from some strong paranoia. I've been doing some research about you and your people, I continued. And the fact is, Tear has a lot to offer the global market. The Screecher population, for one. It's completely out of control in the upper echelon. If it were possible to round them up and train them in various ways, I can guarantee Aventol would trade with Tear.
So we just give the other island screeches?
The captain arched an eyebrow before he took a swig from his wine skein. No. You give them the screechers that know how to carry messages long distances to the other isles, and then keep the secret of how to train them to yourselves, I countered. That's how you keep them coming back. You could also do this with the squallers, too. To my knowledge, the only way to travel anywhere long distance is by ship. Imagine what it would do to Aventol as a whole if the distance between the isles could be shortened. Tear herself could be the one to bring about a new age of communication.
But why stop there?
Siskern added, with an excited expression on his lizard-like face.
Our land has other magnificent beasts the isles could benefit from. Alem could benefit from a train beast, and the rock quarries on Ohm could probably make good use of the drillers.
They will not be ready for hatching for some time,
Tharfin reminded us. Trust me, the Ohm folk don't mind waiting, I remarked, as I thought back to my trusty chef and friend, Arvid. If there was ever something I was sure of, a race of half-sloth men was probably the most patient of all the people in the world, and wouldn't even blink at the fact it took the drill beasts at least 16 years to mature.
I am starting to see the logic in your plan,
Tharfin said after he took a beat to mull this over.
And with the Uppish supposedly out of commission, a lot of their deciding power is limited.
Exactly, Siskern said. My uncle is now the acting Asher Lord, and he has wanted this change for a long time.
And what of Councilman Hess?
The captain queried.
I am of the opinion he is one of the most resistant to change in the upper region. What of him?
Don't you see? I asked instead. Because of the condition of the uppers, when you and your people show up, you'll be holding all the cards, meaning you and your lowish folk will have all the power. They've grown complacent and lazy, and can't even feed themselves without the constant supply from Snake Tree. The reality is, they need you more than you've ever needed them.
The councilman is delusional, and he will not give up his power without a fight,
Tharfin said. But it seemed to be more of a token protest instead of a true counter-argument. And after that, he lapsed into a pensive silence as the rest of us resumed eating our meager dinners of whatever dried foods we had on hand. When it came time for all of us in the hunting party to hunker down for the night, I figured the discussion was tabled for now and decided to let the issue lie. The only thing that gave me confidence our conversation had any sort of impact was the way the captain's face seemed fixed in a frown that looked as if the gears in his head were grinding away. At least the man was giving what we said some thought, which was all we could do for now.
"Hey, Siskern," I whispered a little later, when we were all situated in our bedrolls.
"You awake?"
The raptor man turned over onto his shoulder.
"Hmm?"
"I just wanted to apologize for earlier," I said. "I know you asked me to keep things quiet, and I blew that one out of the water."
"It is all right, Alex."
Siskern gave me an understanding smile.
"I think the mistake was attempting to hide the issue for as long as we did. I'm starting to wonder what Tear would have looked like if the upper echelon reached out toward the lower echelon for help a long time ago. My feeling is, her people would be thriving to their fullest, not languishing on the brink of extinction like we are. Leader Zare made it sound as if the Lowers combined had the manpower to cause an uprising. My uncle and I only ever wanted to prevent a senseless loss of life."
"It makes sense why Zare would lie, though. He was using a smokescreen just like you and Gris to protect his people," I pointed out.
"The heart of the issue is both sides have been afraid of what the other could do for so long, they've isolated themselves from one another. No wonder the island is sick and dying."
"Indeed,"
Siskern said, as my words washed over him. And after that, we drifted into silence until sleep finally rose up and claimed us all. It should be said, however, that sleep most definitely wasn't synonymous with rest. And I didn't know if it was the fact I was camping on the cold, hard ground, or the disastrous lack of meditation I was able to do. But when Siskern shook me awake, I felt like a corpse with rigor mortis and morning breath to match.
"Ugh!"
I groaned and wished I could manifest a piping hot cup of Coley straight into my hands. Or a genie to grant me 3 wishes, all of them Coley, because fuck mornings.
"How are you doing, my friend?"
the regent asked me with a weary smile of his own.
"Ugh, terrible," I couldn't help but snap. "That's to be expected," he said with a nod as he rubbed his eyes. "Being so close to the heart of the island interferes with Aventol's voice. It is hard to tune in and can be a strain on an Ash's mind. It might be difficult, but there is a way for you to push through the static and meditate."
I don't think so, Siskern," I murmured, and then swished some water around my foul-tasting mouth so I could spit it back on the ground.
"I haven't been able to meditate since Senna."
The raptor man's eyes went wide at this, and his expression grew concerned.
"That was quite some time ago, Alex."
"I know," I said, and gritted my teeth.
"Believe me, I know." "Is there anything that can be done?" he asked.
"Maybe," I said in a quiet voice, so as to not be overheard by the captain or even Thass. "When I got through the trials, I spoke with the ancient snake tree spirit. It saw the wound on my mind and told me I needed to find someone in Mindtown named Maz. Apparently they can help me."
"Have you told Thass or the captain yet?" he questioned.
"No, not yet, and I know this might be hypocritical of me, but I would really appreciate it if you didn't mention anything to our paranoid friend," I requested as I rolled up my sleeping materials. It took a while to convince Tharfin we had no hidden agendas or ulterior motives, and I don't want to risk damaging his trust just in case that gets misconstrued.
"I understand,"
Siskern nodded as he finished packing up his own supplies.
"And don't worry, in case you have forgotten, I made a name for myself as a rather good spy."
"Yeah, until you were caught by Gellivane's booby traps like some tragic Victorian horror story," I snorted.
"Apart from that,"
he conceded with a large shit-eating grin, and both he and I snickered.
"In seriousness, though, do not fret, my friend. I will help you find this Maz."
"Thanks," I said, and clapped him on the shoulder. A short while later, the hunting party was loaded up back on the crawlers, and I was seated up front with the captain again. In front of us was a dark tunnel that howled with the whistling wind, and it gave me the deep gut feeling that the penetrating blackness was unnatural somehow, so the only thing I really wanted to do was turn back.
This is where the Mon transitions from the open pit to the underground,
Tharfin informed me.
It's a good thing you have that stone around your neck. The darkness has a way of messing with you.
What is it we'll be looking for? I asked, as the crawlers started on their way into the tunnel.
Worms do almost everything underground, which makes them tough to try and track, he explained. But if you know where to look, there are signs one can follow. For example, when a worm burrows itself into the ground, its tail tries its best to smooth away any evidence of the entrance it left behind. Look on the ground all along the slope. If you see any patterns in the dirt similar to a swirl or a wave, chances are it was from a worm.
Okay, got it, I said. Then what, we track it down and dig it up?
We draw it to the surface, he continued. I did say the worms do almost everything below the ground, but one of the few things they do come to the surface for is to mate. Once we are sure we are close to one of the beasts, we use the crawlers to tap their feet against the ground at a rapid pace to stimulate how a female calls to a potential male by imitating a mating purr. The vibrations are similar to what a competing male would come to expect, so he comes to the surface willingly.
Clever, I remarked. And then we ambush it.
Exactly,
Tharfin said, and we lapsed into another one of those silences he was so fond of. The underground mine was quite different from the open pit above us. Simply put, if the open funnel of the pit was considered the throat, then this was surely the bowels. The smell, for one, was definitely similar to what I would imagine bowels smelling like. Something about it reminded me of the rotten egg smell of sulfur, but it wasn't quite the same. There was a hair more rancidness to it, as if something had recently died somewhere close by. My stone glowed as bright as I could make it in order to slice through the oppressive blackness, but even with the help of the crawler's headlights, it was still like trying to cut through cold cheese with a plastic knife. Our light could only go so far.
Don't worry. Once we get into the main antechamber, we will all be able to light the oil lanterns for more light before we start to really descend,
Thass commented, and I jolted pretty jarringly. We're not even in the main part yet? I asked. It feels like we've been here for a long time already.
That's what this darkness will do to you,
the captain said in a low voice that seemed to reverberate off the tunnel walls.
It plays with your concept of time. I've known men who have come back fickles later to families that they thought had perished, only for them to swear they'd only been down for a day. Some say the darkness somehow mixes with the ore to create the miasma you feel all around you.
I held my stone high and watched the light glitter off the capillaries of glittering gray rock. Is there a reason why the ore does this?
Some have said it came from the jealous moon, Tharfin went on. That Tyr herself is unlike any other island because when the ocean waters rose, Tyr remained still anchored to the world like a thorn until she had no choice but to build herself up to reach the sun. Every age or so, Tyr rises ever higher so she may be closer to Mercedes' warmth. When the Terrans began to mine, however, we released something connected to the old world. It is this festering evil that seems to be infecting Tyr's ore like a virus would infect one's blood.
The imagery was effective, and now every time I caught a glimpse of the glittering ribbons of ore, a slightly nauseous feeling accompanied it. When we made it to the antechamber in who knows how long, we stopped for a quick stretch and so the crawlers could take a drink from some of the standing pools of water. Thass and a few others lit torches and went around lighting certain parts of the wall where an intricately carved network of grooves was arranged. And what I first thought was just some neat decoration was actually a strange irrigation system of sorts. Instead of water, however, the liquid that flowed all along the walls, illuminated the chamber, and highlighted the main shaft was apparently oil. When the torch connected with one of the channels, the flames raced along until it felt like we were being bathed under the red light of a photographer's darkroom. Not too shabby for a people who didn't have electricity. although I wasn't sure if the intense light was any better. There was nothing for it, though, so I just kept my head down and pushed onward with the rest of the hunting party as we approached the mouth of the shaft.
"From here we go on foot, and we can only take 2 crawlers with us," the captain informed us,
and then swiped his hand under the jowls of his skitter, only to come away with his palm covered in a sheen of slime.
"The main shaft is on a steep slope. You must coat the bottoms of your boots with skitter saliva, which will give you the traction you need to keep from slipping."
Then he demonstrated by doing just that, until everyone was following procedure. "All set," I said, as I was wiping my hand off with a special scaled cloth that cleared the stickiness off my fingers better than Goo Gone.
"Arm yourselves,"
was the captain's last order, before we all plunged into the mine shaft that connected the various levels of underground so ore could be transported to the surface. I brought my crossbow around and loaded a bolt with the safety on, and I made sure my eyes and ears were open and alert to any other dangers. After what seemed like at least 30 minutes of endless walking, the captain suddenly threw up his fist for us to halt as he crouched low to the ground on his muscled haunches.
"Thass, Ambassador,"
the man intoned, and after exchanging puzzled looks, we both shrugged and walked over to see what he'd found.
"See that pattern there?"
he said, and traced something that resembled a Nike swish in the dirt. "Wormtail?" I asked.
"Yes," he confirmed. "An old one, but it's definitely a sign."
"How can you tell it's old, Father?" Thass queried.
"The breeze changes with the temperature, causing an ebb and flow much like the tide as the day goes on,"
the captain explained, like a dude who knew what he was doing, and we were on some Animal Planet show or something.
"From the weathering, you can tell this track has been disturbed by the rising wind gusts at least 3 times, making it at least a day old."
"But are we heading in the right direction at least?" I asked.
"Oh, yes," Tharfin grinned. "We shall reach our target shortly."
Thass and I smiled at each other, but the small amount of triumph was cut short by a vibration building under our feet. "Do you feel that?" I asked as I looked down.
"What is it?"
Thass peered at our feet.
"A worm?"
"No."
The captain trailed off as he squinted up the slope with a frown.
"This is something else."
"Captain!"
someone screamed from behind us, and I turned just in time to see one of Tharfin's men get sucked underground like a sinkhole the size of his body just opened up.
"What's happening?"
Siskern yelled, as he whipped around, only to see another hapless victim get swallowed up by the earth.
"Ground leeches!"
Tharfin roared, and his pupils dilated to slits.
"Run!"